On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
And I'd like to welcome Miriam Davis, who's the author of a new book that is about a serial killer about whom you have never heard. But if you had been living in New Orleans back in the early part of the 20th century, this is the story that would have kept you awake at night. The book is The Axe Man of New Orleans. It's from Chicago Review Press. And my guest is Miriam C. Davis. And Miriam, thank you for driving down to be with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. Well,
how did you even find out about this obscure yet kind of creepy thing that happened in New Orleans back in the early part of the 20th century?
Well, my youngest brother, Tim, brought it to my attention. Some years ago, we were sitting on my front porch, shooting breeze, talking about serial killers, because we both have this kind of macabre interest. And he mentioned that when he was, a child, like in the seventh grade, that he read in an anthology about this killer in New Orleans who went around whacking, and he thought it was Jewish bakers, but It turned out to be Italian grocers. So at the time, I was involved in writing my first book, but I procrastinate. And one of the great ways you have of procrastinating now is to Google stuff.
Right.
So I was sitting in my office, waiting for students to show up, and there was plenty I could have been doing, but I decided just to start Googling this Axeman of New Orleans. And it turns out that if you are an aficionado of serial killers, you would have run across the Axeman of New Orleans in various anthologies. And there was a fair amount about him on the web. And I traced it back all to a New Orleans writer in the 1950s, Robert Talent. In the 1950s, in 1952, he published a book called Ready to Hang that had a chapter on the Axeman. The Axeman wore wings. Most of what you find in these anthologies is a rehash of what he said in the 1950s. But there arose certain questions about his account. And one was, he concentrated on the series of murders from 1918 to 1919. But he brought up the possibility that some police at the time had remembered that there were a similar set of killings in 1911. He mentioned some names, Sciambra, Cruti, Rossetti, or some variation thereof.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one writer, true crime writer, said, well, no, that, if you looked at the New Orleans records, there was no mention of anybody by that name being killed in 1911.
Hmm.
So, well, at the time, my husband and I went to New Orleans once or twice a year and talk about serendipity. The public library that has the New Orleans City records is in the business district just across Canal Street from the quarter.
Okay.
So it was very easy one Saturday afternoon for me to cross Canal Street and go up to the third floor and look at the coroner's reports. And I found that indeed in 1911, nobody by these names, Cruti, Rossetti, or Sciambra, had been killed. But an Italian grocer named Joe Davy had been killed in a way very much like these killings in 1919. His wife had been cut. He himself had had his head bashed in. So this made me think, nobody's ever really researched this.
Right.
So I thought, there's a book here. And for various reasons, in 2011, I left my teaching job and moved to Montgomery. And it gave me the opportunity to really research this story. And it turned out that there was really a lot more to it. I just discovered a lot more than any previous writers had discovered, even though while I was writing, two pretty decent accounts of the Axeman story came out that just about,
Yike.
Well, one of them was really late in the publication process. So this would have been really a disaster. But
right.
One of them was Kevin McQueen, who wrote a book about murders in the South, and he wrote a chapter about the Axeman. It's a pretty decent summary of the Axeman story, some useful information. And he himself was a lot of help to me. I got in touch with him. We actually knew somebody in common, and he, by email, was a lot of help to me.
Okay.
And the other was Gary Crist, who wrote Empire of Sin about corruption, a story about corruption
right.
in New Orleans. And he sort of used the Axeman story to kind of, I think, build atmosphere for that
right,
time.
Right.
I don't think he really so much was interested in solving it as just sort of using it for background.
Right. So in both cases, this was not the pivotal point of their book. It was involved in it, but not the focus of the book.
Right. And I felt that while they did a pretty decent job of summarizing the newspaper accounts, that there was a lot more to be said. So I thought, I breathed this great sigh of relief and sort of truly. In March of this year, my book was published.
Let's tell a little bit about the nature of the crimes is what makes them interesting. Is not exactly the right word, but what makes them memorable, that there was such a brutality to the attack.
That is, there were two sets of attacks right. in 1910, 1911, and then beginning in late 1917 to 1919 in New Orleans, right. and then in the early 1920s elsewhere in Louisiana. The first set of attacks, I think this is just when the Axeman is getting started, he actually uses a cleaver of some sort that he steals from a butcher's. And sometimes he abandons the cleaver. In the case of Joe Davey in 1911, they never found the cleaver, but okay. his wounds were
consistent.
Exactly. Starting in 1917, the attack in December of 1917, he did use a hatchet, sort of a big hatchet. Starting in 1918, he uses an axe. Mm-hmm. Everybody, and this is my theory. You know, at first he's carrying this butcher's cleaver that he's stolen, but that's a lot of trouble and entails risks.
Right.
He doesn't want to take it with him because walking through the streets of New Orleans with a bloody cleaver at 3 a.m. is just, let's face it, it's suspicious.
Yeah.
But at the time, everybody would have had an axe at their house because everybody had wood-burning stoves.
Right.
Everybody's backyard would have had an axe. So it was very easy to take the homeowner's axe and to use that as a weapon and then abandon it there.
Which meant that eliminated the possibility of them tracing the weapon or being caught with the weapon. Pretty shrewd.
Exactly. And the other thing about the Axeman in this clear pattern, he attacks Italian grocers. The cases in which it was not an Italian grocer, when you look at the details, it just doesn't fit the pattern. He attacks between 1 and 3 in the morning, usually on a moonless night. So there's evidence that he had some burglary skills. So my theory, after talking to a profiler and a homicide detective, is that he started off as a burglar and progressed to killing.
There is an element of ethnicity in this. And you did research to figure out why this particular group of people was apparently being targeted. And that's pretty interesting in and of itself. And it has to do with labor availability in the Deep South mm-hmm. during that time and the post-slavery era.
Yep.
Italians were brought in as workers in...
After the Civil War, white planters did not want to, for various reasons, did not want to deal with black labor if they could help it. And they tried various. They brought in the Delta Chinese are well known. They brought in other groups. But then they hit on using Sicilian labor. And starting in like the 1870s, you have this flood of Sicilians who come into New Orleans. Sometimes they come through New York, but they come into Louisiana, Mississippi to work in the cane fields and the cotton fields. And they were hard workers, they were really frugal, but the only drawback as far as the planters were concerned is that they didn't want to stay laborers forever. They would save every penny they could, they would grow their own food in their own gardens, and as soon as they could, they would go into business for themselves. And starting as just traveling salesmen, you know, selling whatever they could carry, and then moving up to buying groceries. And in fact, in the period that these attacks occur, because 80% of the Italians who come into New Orleans in the late 19th, early 20th century, 80% of them are Sicilians, they're taking over this niche of the corner grocery. That is, at the time, of course, nobody has a refrigerator. All you've got is an icebox.
Right. Everybody shops every day for the food you're going to cook that day.
Usually twice. A woman will shop in the morning to cook dinner, and then shop again in the afternoon to cook supper. And so on every corner, basically, there would be a grocery. Sicilians are in the process of taking over that niche. And I mean, some Sicilians, through the food service industry, they become actually quite wealthy. So they're a rising class. You know, this is the era of segregation. This was in the era of when society is very clearly divided between black and white. The Sicilians were kind of liminal, came from southern Italy. There'd been Italians in New Orleans since before the Civil War, but they were usually northern Italians. The southern Italians spoke a completely different dialect. And in some ways, they weren't even considered real Italians. They tended to be rather dark-skinned.
Swarthy.
Yes. And they didn't quite fit into this, you know, one or the other.
Right.
And
right.
So
they could kind of move between the two worlds
or
be excluded by both worlds.
Exactly. Exactly. Blacks didn't necessarily show them the respect they were required to show to whites. For some whites, many whites, they were what they call black dagos. Yeah. That was, it's offensive, but that's the term that was used at the time. Nevertheless, some Italians were making their way very successfully in the white world and rising. And there was clearly some social anxiety about this and some resentment. And one of the most famous examples of this was the lynching of 11 Italians in 1891. And this is the biggest, I believe I'm right to say it's the biggest mass lynching in U.S. history. In 1890, the chief of police in New Orleans, David Hennessy, was murdered. And he is supposed to have said, as he's dying, the Dagos did it. And there was a trial of a big group of Italians were arrested. First trial of the first, I believe, seven ended in either a guilt, no verdict whatsoever, or not guilty verdict. Some people were enraged, and some 8,000 people stormed the jail and lynched some of these who'd been acquitted, some of these who hadn't been tried yet. And so this is something that lingered for a very long time. For a very long time, it was very offensive to say to an Italian, "Who killed a chief?"
Ooh.
Because that was a sort of chant that had come out of this incident. So there was real anxiety. And so I think it is significant that it's this particular class of people who were targeted.
Yeah.
One theory, and this was suggested to me by the homicide detective that I consulted, is that this individual, the axeman, clearly had some experience with burglary. He said maybe an Italian grocer testified against him and sent him to prison. That could be it.
Yeah.
Maybe he was we know from eyewitness accounts that this axeman was white. He was working class because of the way he was dressed.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps he had come from a family that had lost their business in competition with Italians. Maybe he really had this resentment of these Italians who are climbing the social ladder. But I do believe, I am convinced, that he is targeting Italian grocers. I think it had nothing to do with the so-called mafia. I think that the cases that were not of Italian grocers can be explained in other ways. That's my theory. And I'll say it's completely a theory. But I think it's a theory that matches the known facts.
We're talking, if you're just joining us, to Miriam C. Davis, Ph.D. in history, the author of Dame Kathleen Kenyon, An Account of the Life of the Most Important Female Archaeologist of the 20th Century. She lectures for Smithsonian Journeys and lives in Montgomery and made the drive down here to Troy to visit with us today to talk about her book, The Axeman of New Orleans, The True Story, from Chicago Review Press. There was a sort of a proto-mafia called the Black Hand that was suspected, or at least was one of the theories floating around for one of the attacks, as I recall from your book, but pretty early on discounted. This group generally targeted Italians and was kind of an extortion racket more than anything else, but there were apparently some attacks or bombings or something like that. Am I remembering that right?
Well, I don't think that there was one group called the Black Hand. Now, people believed in this Black Hand society, which they often use interchangeably with the mafia. What it was a kind of extortion that was very common in immigrant communities, not just in New Orleans, but in Chicago and anywhere there was a large immigrant Italian community.
Right.
And it was because, first of all, the immigrants were very reluctant for various reasons to go to the police. They were very suspicious of the police.
Right.
The police in Sicily, where they come from, were not terribly helpful.
Right.
And I think there were lots of groups indulging in this kind of blackmail.
It's kind of like, you'll excuse not a great analogy, but in The Princess Bride, you have the Dread Pirate Roberts, and it's whoever happens to call himself that, that's who the Dread Pirate Roberts is. So the Black Hand is whoever claims to be the Black Hand. It's not like they have a board meeting and say, okay, you know, who's controlling the West Side?
Right, exactly. But so there certainly were groups of thugs who engage in this kind of extortion. And what would often happen is you get a letter in Italian written in this very eloquent, friendly language, dear friend, da-da-da-da, and requesting money. And in many cases, if the money wasn't paid, there were serious consequences. A bomb could be thrown into your business and your business destroyed. So it was, there were cases of when people get a Black Hand letter, their insurance is canceled. I mean, this was taken very, very seriously.
Yeah.
And Joe Davy, it turned out that Joe Davy, some months previous, had received a Black Hand letter and had just laughed it off. And people did laugh off some of them because it's clear that some people just did it to see, what they could get out of it and had no intention of burning down somebody's business. Right. If you look at the details of the Davie murder, this was not a Black Hand murder because there was – you don't want to kill the proprietor. And they, if they tried to kill the proprietor, they would have been successful in killing him and his wife. And they didn't. The person didn't make a real hard effort to kill the wife. But what they want to do is intimidate you by threatening your business, so that you'll pay up.
Right. That I mean that if you kill them, you're not going to get any money. So that's counterproductive.
But if you destroy their business, they will know to take you seriously.
Yeah. And everybody else will too.
Exactly.
Sends a message.
It certainly does.
So the threat becomes as effective as actually having to do anything. And that's why these attacks don't really seem to fit that. Plus the fact that it had been quite a passage of time since he'd gotten the letter. It wasn't like the day before.
Right.
Which might have been a little more indicative that these guys were involved, but not with the passage of time.
Yeah, I don't think so.
They just waited too long to do it.
Right.
The first attack on Davie kills him. And again, what makes these things so nerve-wracking is they're always in the wee hours of the morning. Mm-hmm. Everybody's asleep. They're attacked in bed. Mm-hmm. And there was one case, and this was in the later series, that a child was in the bed with them, which was not unheard of. Mm-hmm. And so this seems particularly vicious and cruel. These people, first of all, attacked in their sleep, so they have no way of defending themselves. And they're just as likely to kill a woman or a child as they are the man.
They more consistently kill the man. They do, the X-Men, attacks the child. If a child is there, in the case of Mary Cortimiglia, she's the one who's killed and can attack the wife. But one of the things you notice in terms of the pattern, it's the man who is usually attacked first, mm-hmm. and that could be just to, you know, get him out of the way.
Right, so to eliminate any kind of struggle.
Right, but also I just think that he doesn't often make a real attempt to kill the wife, where he does make a real attempt after his first couple of tries, in which they're kind of half-hearted, and I think this is when he starts getting started and doesn't quite know what he's doing.
He's escalating.
Yes, it is clearly escalating, because after there's a Davie murder in June of 1911. There's a period of about 6 years where he's gone, where I suspect he was in prison for some other crime like burglary.
Right.
He comes back in December of 1917, where he attacks the Andolina family. Nobody is seriously hurt. But then when he starts to attack again in May of 1918, attacks Joe and Catherine Maggio. After that, there's always a fatality. He sort of figured out what he's doing.
Yeah, how to do it.
And it's usually not always, but usually it's the man who is killed.
Yeah, and they're not, aren't they attacked in the face, in the head?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And that's a scary thing, too, to come into a crime scene and have someone lying there in a pool of blood.
Well, it's usually the skull is fractured. So he's hitting them hard enough to fracture the skull. So, in the case of the Maggios, it's kind of interesting. I mean, I think that's the most brutal of these murders. Both Catherine Maggio was, in fact, not hit with an axe. Joe Maggio was. He had his skull fractured, but both of them had their throats cut. What's interesting, and in no other case that I know of were they cut with a razor, but from the position of Catherine Maggio's body, the police speculated that she actually got out of bed and ran around to defend her husband. And that's when the axeman struck with the razor and cut her throat. And he cut the jugular, he cut the carotid artery, and she bled to death at the same time that she's choking on her own blood. And so if she had stayed put, like most of these women do out of shock or whatever, she might well have gotten off with some blows to the head. But I really do think that, to me, is the most gruesome of these attacks, which are pretty gruesome as a whole lot. But.
Right, right. There's one woman who's disfigured. Was that the Miss Davie that survives but is disfigured? She's sort of traumatized by the attack.
Well, I think you might be referring to the Bessemer attack, which I don't think was an X-Men attack. I think it was an incident of domestic violence. But certainly Harriet Lowe, who was the woman who was severely attacked and later, some months later, died of her injuries. I think she actually died of meningitis, but it was caused by her injuries. She was disfigured and had like a twitch in her face.
The most disconcerting thing about all of this is the police are actively seeking the attacker, even though they don't all make the connection that it's the, in fact, very few of them, right, make the connection that the earlier attacks are related to the later attacks.
Yes. I think there's some confusion about that because there's been a big change in the police force in that period of time. Mm-hmm. There's a new police chief, one of the detectives who's involved in both sets of murders, just believed that they were robberies gone wrong. But the Italian, the so-called Italian detective, John D'Antonio, he believed, he gave an interview after he retired, he believed they were connected. And he didn't believe they had, he was a mafia expert. He believed they had nothing to do with the mafia. He actually came up with, I think, a pretty decent profile of the kind of person who did it. He thought he was a kind of Jekyll and Hyde character. Mm. And I think he came the closest to creating an accurate profile of the killer.
They never caught the Axeman of New Orleans, as far as we know.
As far as we know.
There was a trial, and mm-hmm. there was somebody convicted, but it was obvious that they were not guilty. That may be the most interesting story of all of the attacks.
Yeah, this is when, I think probably under pressure from the police, the Axeman moves across the river into the community of Gretna, which is now part of Greater New Orleans, but
right.
at the time was its own little town, and attacks Italian grocers, the Cortimiglia family. Mary and Charlie Cortimiglia are severely injured, but it's their 2-year-old daughter, Mary, who's killed.
Right.
The New Orleans police, or the police chief, is telling the Gretna authorities, this is our, he didn't use the term serial killer, they called him a fiend. This is our fiend.
Yeah.
And in fact, they sent their Bertillon expert, who was the closest they had to CSI at the time, over to help. But for some reason, and I can only speculate about the reasons, the Gretna authorities became convinced that their next-door neighbors, the Giordanos, who were also Italian grocers, who had been in business competition with them, who'd had kind of a legal dispute with them, mm-hmm. that they must be guilty. And when Rosie Cortimiglia and her husband, Charlie, are the ones who were attacked, they're so badly wounded, they're in Charity Hospital for several weeks. And the evidence suggests that basically they were harangued by the police, who said, you know, was it the Giordanos? Was it the Giordanos? Over and over again.
Right.
And from the testimony we have of the physicians who were taking care of them, they had no idea.
Right.
When Rosie was finally released from the hospital, she was immediately arrested as a material witness and put in Gretna jail and not released until she signed an affidavit and began to say it was her neighbors, the Giordanos,
right.
who did it. And so it was only on her testimony that they were convicted. And we have the trial transcript because it was appealed to the Louisiana State Supreme Court. And if you read her testimony, her story really doesn't make much sense.
Yeah.
But, you know, she made a very sympathetic witness. I think, you know, this was a time when people really didn't know about serial killers. And in fact, many police officers don't even believe in serial killers until like the 1970s. So I think the jury, in all good faith, convicted them because, you know, there's an eyewitness account saying they must have. Well, 7 months later, I believe it is, Rosie walks into the offices of the Times-Picayune and says, and there just happens to be a lawyer and a notary there, and signs a statement that says they didn't do it, that she says, I was basically harangued until, you know, everybody was telling me they must have done it, they must have done it. But she says, I don't know who did it. By that time, they had been convicted. And 17-year-old Frank, I mean, his elderly father, he was 69 or 70 at the time, which was very, very old in the early
right.
20th century, had been sentenced to life. And 17-year-old Frank had been sentenced to hang. The only reason Frank hadn't been hanged is that his case had been appealed to the Louisiana State Supreme Court. When the Supreme Court is considering the case, legally they cannot consider what Rosie has said. They have to do it completely on the legal merits of the case.
Right.
But a month after this, they declare the original verdict void because the police, the district attorney, has willfully withheld potentially exculpatory evidence and has done other things in the course of the trial which prejudiced the jury.
Yeah.
And so there were several grounds on which the verdict was overturned. The DA doesn't give up, though. They keep them in jail because they said they're going to retry them. And in fact, Rosie is threatened with charges of perjury. But eventually, mm-hmm. in December of 1920, by the charges are dismissed and they walk free. Orlando, the father, dies at home a few years later. Frank himself goes on to be a very successful businessman in the New Orleans area. It has a happy ending.
Yeah. Convoluted situation. The ethnicity of the people involved is part of the mix. No one has ever been tried and convicted of being the axe murderer, being the serial killer.
No. There were two trials. There was of victims who were suspected of being Axeman victims. One was the Giordanos, but the other was of Harriet Lowe's. We suppose that she was his mistress. There's only speculation about it. But Louis Bessemer. Now, I don't think that was an Axeman murder. I think he did attack her because the evidence is just, there's a really different pattern.
Right.
But he was never accused of being the Axeman. Frank, nobody ever believed Frank was going around killing other people. They were both accused of particular murders.
Yeah.
But no, and I found evidence of Axeman attacks after he left New Orleans in 1919, and he's moving westward. And I have this like dream that since the book is coming out, somebody will read it and remember that in 1925 in their little town in Texas, that somebody was caught coming out of an Italian grocer's at 3 a.m. holding a bloody axe, and they hung him.
Yeah.
And that will be the Axeman. Because this is a particular kind of killing. It's a particular signature.
Right.
And so it's not very likely that many people are out doing this. And so I think there's a slim, I mean, it's very slim, but I think there's a very slim possibility that he's still out there to be found in a sense.
Certainly anywhere there were pockets of Sicilian immigrants, he would have a target.
Yes, he would.
And there were pockets of Sicilian immigrants across the South.
Well, that's why Louis Bessemer, he and supposedly, I guess, his mistress, Harriet Lowe, were attacked. She gives several different stories when she's in the hospital, and she's, you know, up to the gills and opioids. And, you know, one of her stories is she says, oh, my husband, she was claiming at the time to be married to Louis Bessemer. He's a German spy. Well, this was 1918.
In a major port city.
They took this very seriously.
Sure.
And they went through, they called in the feds, and there was no FBI at the time, but they called in, I guess, whatever the predecessor was. And they went through all of his belongings, found a secret compartment in one of his chests or boxes or something, found letters written in foreign languages. And the newspapers are not consistent about what language they were written in. One newspaper said, though, Yiddish. But Yiddish is very close to German, High German. That really ginned up a lot of animosity towards Bessemer. But in the end, it turned out to be nothing, and he was never formally accused of anything like that. But just saying, my husband's a German spy, just brought it down on him like a ton of bricks.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a fascinating story. I'm so glad that you got intrigued about it and wrote about it, and done an awful lot of research. I would say that probably this is kind of the definitive book about this little known outside of New Orleans serial killer back in the early part of the 20th century. Police departments begin to take seriously the idea of motivation and drive and what makes a person become a criminal other than just greed, which up to that point was considered. Greed or revenge were about the only things that they considered as real reasons anybody would do stuff like that.
Right. That I think is behind the Gretna authorities not taking seriously this idea that there's somebody going around attacking Italian grocers. I think that, you know, they were very familiar with the idea of the Italian vendetta, and which was, you know, a common thing in certainly in the 19th century of, you know, Italians not taking their problems to the police, but shooting each other.
Right.
And, you know, a business conflict, that made sense to them. Whereas this idea of somebody killing for any other reason, as you say, than greed or revenge, just, you know, didn't compute.
Wow, this really is a neat story. Horrifying, don't get me wrong. It's nothing. It's kind of like watching Criminal Minds on television, Freak of the Week.
Mm-hmm.
You get into the mind of somebody who's the perpetrator, and you realize how people can do terrible things if they're convinced that what they're doing isn't terrible in their own mind.
Yes, but what I found is that, you know, for television and movies, serial killers always, to me, turn out to be more interesting than they really are.
Yeah.
Because when you get down to it, serial killers actually tend to be a lot the same, and they're kind of boring.
Yeah.
And they tend to be, you know, most of them are not Ted Bundys. And this old idea of somebody, Hannibal Lecter, who's this genius serial killer. I mean, the whole reason people become serial killers is basically because they're losers. And this is what I think is behind the Axeman. I think he was a loser who blamed his loserness on this rising class. You know, there have been several novels based on the story of the Axeman. And in the novels, there's always some complex, deep, profound reason.
But that's what you do in a novel.
Yes, yes. And I think it's because basically this guy's not all that interesting. And that's why he does what he does.
Yeah. Fascinating story, though. Miriam Davis, our guest today, the author of The Axeman of New Orleans, The True Story. It is from Chicago Review Press. I'm guessing they can find this in bookstores and libraries and
certainly
online everywhere.
Yes.
Thank you, Miriam. I appreciate you making the jaunt down here. And when you have your next book, let's do this again.
Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure and it will be a pleasure. Thank you so much.
We'll see you next week right here on your favorite radio station and also on my website on thebookshelf.biz. Thanks again to my wife, Becky Kirby, for getting the website back up and running. We'll see you next week. Till then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.